This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Isn't it equal?
Welcome to Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson at WDET in Detroit. There's an awful lot going on as the school year ends on college campuses this spring, where we've seen pro-Palestinian voices rise to organize protests of the war that Israel is waging in Gaza. College presidents have been really challenged to figure a response to these demonstrations, which have been peaceful but also disruptive, which, by the way, is the very point of protest. This clash between authority and speech, though, hit a real crescendo last night in New York as police officers were called in to disband the encampments that protesters had erected at Columbia University. And this was a harrowing scene. First, the press were escorted away from the scene before the police went in to clear the encampments. And what footage we've been able to see of the police doing that is absolutely horrifying. There's no way to describe the police response here as anything other than violent. And that has been true at other universities as well, as police have physically assaulted protesters, in some cases even professors, who've been part of the demonstrations. Of course, this is not new in America or in academia or in the history of social protest in our country. There's always been a strain between the free speech rights of demonstrators and the desire of authorities to maintain what they call law and order. And every major protest movement at some point has been brutalized by authority. But I think there's something special about the idea of protests on college campuses. In the very idea of a college or university convened around the pursuit of truth through dialogue, inquiry, and even conflict. Shouldn't we want students who feel strongly about something, politics, culture, what have you, to express those feelings not just through speech, but also through demonstration? And shouldn't we expect college presidents and others who run our campuses to be encouraging of that expression and nurturing of the opportunity for the exchange of ideas that these demonstrations invite? Now, I know that the subject of these protests is really sensitive right now. There are an awful lot of people who are conflicted about what's happening in the Middle East. And it's hard to have a conversation with anybody right now, really, about that subject. And so these protests really remind us of that difficulty. They strike at the heart of that conflict that's going on in our hearts and our minds. But they're still governed, or should be, by our notion of free speech and the exchange of ideas. Again, something that should be sacred on a college campus. 30 years ago, when I arrived at the University of Michigan, there was another era of protest underway about lots of things. South Africa and the apartheid state that was run in South Africa was the subject of almost daily protests on campus. The Middle East, even then, was the subject of demonstrations. The first week I was on campus, there was even a massive demonstration to protest the inauguration of a new president at the university. This was part of college life. This was part of the inquiry of college life, the things that we were doing as part of academia. So it's been really hard for me to watch the response to the protests this spring. What on earth is going on these college campuses? What on earth is going on in the minds of these college presidents calling the cops to clear peaceable demonstrations by their students? That's where we begin our conversation today, as police swarm in to forcibly and sometimes violently put down protests that frankly seem pretty benign on the spectrum of this kind of speech. They are disruptive, but they are not violent. We've got two great guests to help us sort through all of this. Sophia Rosenfeld is the chair of the Department of History at the University of Pennsylvania, where she teaches European and American intellectual and cultural history. Dr. Rosenfeld, welcome to Created Equal.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Shika Dalmia. She is the president of the Institute for the Study of Modern Authoritarianism. She's also the editor-in-chief of The Unpopulist, a free Substack publication that's devoted to defending liberal democracies from populist nationalism. Shika, it's always great to talk with you. Welcome to Created Equal as well.
Thanks for having me back, Stephen. It's been a while.
It has. I also, before we get to the conversation, want to invite our listeners to participate. Give us a call and let us know, should students be able to occupy a square on a campus or buildings on a campus in protest? And should police be involved in the response to these protests when they refuse to disband? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Created Equal or at WDET, and we can include you in the conversation that way. So I want to start with what happened last night. The Columbia encampment was dismantled. The New York Police Department forcibly removed students who were occupying Hamilton Hall, a place that has been a site of protest more than once. If we go back to the 60s, there were anti-war protests there. There was also student protests to end South African apartheid there in the era when I was in school at the University of Michigan. I want to get both of your reactions to what we saw, what we were able to see, of what happened last night. Dr. Rosenfeld, I'll start with you.
Okay, sure. Well, I will say that it's been extremely disturbing all week to see pictures of police action, some of it really rather brutal police action, places like Indiana, Texas, where the police seem heavily militarized and really a show of force that's disproportionate to what's going on, to my mind. That included Columbia on the first clearing of the encampments. Last night, there was a slightly different sense about what happened, I think, because it was the occupation of a building happened in a slightly different fashion. But I will say that I agree with the basic premise we're talking about here, which is that students in general need to have a very wide latitude for speech on campuses. That doesn't mean anything goes at all. It doesn't mean that, you know, you can advocate violence, that you can engage in violence. There are restrictions about time, place, and manner. There also should be restrictions about certain kinds of really noxious hate speech. But that said, it's essential to the academic mission of universities that students be given a really big space for talking about what they want to talk about. Same for faculty. I would refer to academic freedom as much as the First Amendment here. Mm-hmm. So what we saw last night was indeed disturbing.
Yeah, yeah. Shika, one of the things that has been going through my mind all week is what we saw in, I believe it was 2017, in Charlottesville near the University of Virginia, when, you know, a torch-bearing rabble of right-wing protesters marched through the streets with their lit torches and chanting very offensive phrases about their sense of what was happening, what was changing in America. And the response to that, there was very little police presence at that march, and they certainly didn't engage with those protesters in the way that we're seeing people or police engage with the protesters here. Obviously, nothing is kind of an apples to apples comparison. There were lots of differences, but that's been going through my mind all week, that this there's something different about this than we often see when students or groups of people who believe something different than what these protesters are talking about are engaged in similar behavior.
Yeah, you know, what's been going through my mind, Stephen, watching these protests unfold over the entire country, campuses in the whole country, is that we are actually in some ways seeing the reenactment of Charlottesville, which I think I take your point. I mean, there is something similar there. But actually the civil rights era, where there was a clear divide in how southern states were handling protests by Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders with violence and, the full force of law enforcement, and northern states. And setting aside Columbia for a second, for a minute, I'll come to it. But in the South, there has been an extremely disturbing authoritarian response to the protests. I mean, Governor Abbott didn't waste a single moment to bring in riot police to deal with absolutely peaceful protests. Not just that, they savaged photojournalists and video journalists and other media, and very, very violently disbanded those protesters. Things have been a little bit different. I mean, in Washington University, I was watching some footage last night of police savaging a university professor, beating him, and then dragging his limp body into a van. But I think in northern campuses, setting aside Columbia, there has been a variety of responses. And the ones that have worked, I think there have been a few instances where this has been handled well. I think Princeton has been one, Johns Hopkins has been one, where there were very clear rules established in advance that have been consistently enforced in a viewpoint-neutral way. So, for instance, in Princeton, the president issued a statement saying that even though technically some encampments and some forms of expression might be a violation of time, place, and manner restrictions that Sophia was talking about, they would still tolerate them so long as they didn't morph into violence, intimidation, and harassment of Jewish students on campus. That's not how Columbia has handled the situation. Columbia President Shafiq, I hate to say this, but she has made a complete mess of the situation. She has been too eager to appease congressional critics who are accusing Columbia of anti-Semitism to react in a completely ham-handed way to the protests. So she went in a congressional hearing, and because she had learned from the example of the previous hearing with University of Pennsylvania, MIT, and Harvard presidents, where they got accused of anti-Semitism, she came out very hard against the protesters and assured congressional leaders that she was going to crack down on these protests. And the next day she called in the riot police, or if not the riot police, but NYPD. And of course, that just inflamed the situation and caused more encampments and more protests from students. And yesterday she had to then resort to the ultimate action and bring in the NYPD again and arrest and suspend. And, things got kind of ugly.
Yeah. Dr. Rosenfeld, it seems to me that, as Sheikha's pointing out, this does call back to several different eras on college campuses. The one where I was in college in the late 80s and the 90s, where you did see an awful lot of social protest demonstrations about lots of different issues. And of course, 30 years before that, in the 1960s, where we saw civil rights protests and anti-war protests, not just on college campuses, but lots of places. Can you talk about what's different, or I guess what's changed that we may be witnessing now that kind of separates what's going on here from those eras, and how our notions, especially on college campuses, about speech and what's acceptable speech seem to have changed as well?
Yes, yeah, sure. I think there are two major factors we can point to that really make this a little different. And the point of comparison for me wouldn't really be Charlottesville, a place I used to live, so I know very intimately, because mm-hmm. those people were not community members and they were not students. It was a kind of outside infiltration mm-hmm. of the city. These are much more, these demonstrations really come up from the bottom, which is to say they really percolated up from students. And community people have joined in, but they're not outside forces arriving in these spaces. They're really battles within universities. Mm-hmm. And in that way, I think you're right. They really evoke more something like the 60s and the Vietnam War protests, when a divided society saw its divisions play out on campuses too. My era, which is clearly yours too, of the anti-apartheid in South Africa demonstrations of the late 80s and early 90s, for instance, I think we're different in a way and did not provoke this kind of violence because there was some more general consensus that the students were on the right side. Hmm. In this moment, several things have shifted. One, the battle is between who's the real defender of free speech has been swinging wildly between the right and the left over the last few years. That's an important factor in all this, a sense of who free speech really benefits, the powerful or the distressed and the subjugated. And the other thing that I think has really shifted is that this particular battle is playing out at a moment when we're in a deeply polarized political environment. It's playing out in the U.S. in the year of an election of a president that's an extremely fraught election. It's playing out in the era of social media, where much of the demonstrators sometimes have demands that are specific to universities, but sometimes it's much more a sort of need to be seen, yeah. which contributes to a larger global effort to shift opinion about Israel and Gaza. In that sense, these are very tough battles. They are pitting people on opposing political sides. They're being weaponized by everybody in sight, from politicians to people meet in the media looking for clicks. Mm-hmm. They are pitting certain values against each other, an important sense of the necessity of calling attention to the atrocity of what's happening in Gaza.
I think we have
a background.
There we go.
All of this is playing out.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Dr. Rosenfeld and with Shika Dalmia about what is happening on college campuses right now. We want to get going with you, the listeners, on the phones and on social. Call and tell us what you make of what we're seeing happen on college campuses. Do you support the idea that students should be able to disrupt even normal happenings on a campus with social protests, with demonstrations? What's the limit? At what point should college presidents be able to call in authorities to disband these protests? Are these protests being treated differently because of what the students are saying, because they are pro-Palestinian and critical of Israel's war in Gaza? Is that okay? 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter, hashtag CreatedEqual or at WDET, and be part of the program that way. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. We'll be right back. You're listening to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you've joined. We're talking about what we saw last night in New York City as New York police, cleared an encampment at Columbia University of students who were protesting the Israel war in Gaza. We're talking about these demonstrations, which are taking place on campuses in many places in our country, and what the response has been, what the response should be. How should we handle this kind of speech on college campuses? What should students be able to do? And what the response should be? How should college presidents and other university officials respond to these kinds of demonstrations? I think that they ought to be inviting them into the dialogue and encouraging the kind of dialogue that they provoke. Lots of presidents have taken a different tack, though, and decided that they need to clear those protests on their campuses. We want to hear from you as well while we have this conversation. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag CreatedEqual or at WDET. We've got two great guests with us. Sophia Rosenfeld is the chair of the Department of History at the University of Pennsylvania. She teaches European and American intellectual and cultural history. Shika Dalmia is with us as well. She's the president of the Institute for the Study of Modern Authoritarianism. She also runs a Substack called The Unpopulist, which is devoted to defending liberal democracies. Dr. Rosenfeld, I want to talk about the piece that you wrote recently in the New York Times about what's going on college campuses. The headline was, "I teach a class on free speech. My students can show us the way forward." I'm always curious about what people who have contact with college students on a daily basis are hearing from them about how they think about these issues and how they're reacting to what's going on. Tell us what it is that you're hearing from your students that you think is instructive for the rest of us.
Well, I welcome that opportunity because I do think that sometimes students get a very bad rap in the press that they're either snowflakes and can't take anything, or they're just always out there yelling slogans that they don't understand. You know, that they're portrayed in sort of ways that don't reflect what I generally see. Now, I'm only seeing one campus, the University of Pennsylvania, where students have indeed set up an encampment. But I will say the administration has really held back. They've said that it's breaking the rules, but they haven't done anything. They've called in no police. There are campus security forces out there, but they're hanging back a fair amount. So for the moment, things are pretty calm, and students are getting the chance to exercise their free speech rights out on the campus. Mm-hmm. But what's really striking, I think, is that we see a few students in sort of strident positions on the very edges of the discourse always. But what we don't often see is the vast majority who are actually trying to feel their way in very nuanced ways through these various debates. And they don't come out with all their ideas already set in stone. Most of them are trying to figure out where they stand. They're trying to learn. Even the students in the encampments have been having a series of lectures, discussions. They've invited guests in to talk in a sort of pedagogical fashion. What we see are a few students, you know, who look menacing, saying incendiary things, but that isn't really the norm. I don't think anywhere. Those are the difficult cases to deal with for sure. But students are, they're not even sure where they stand on questions of academic freedom, much less where they stand on questions about what should be done to solve the problem of Palestine in relation to Israel. So I think if we talk to students more, we'd actually hear a much more nuanced picture than what we're getting in the media.
I mean, it sounds like the protests and the I guess the crucible of a college campus is kind of doing what it's supposed to do in your judgment, which is to provoke thought to provoke the exchange of ideas.
Yeah, I mean, to my mind, a college campus is a place for learning. It's a place for research, but it's also a place for questioning. And the reason that there should be a wide latitude for speech on campuses goes to the mission of universities, which is different from other kinds of businesses or enterprises, whether they're public or private. And that is to learn or to advance knowledge, you have to be able to question the status quo. And sometimes that's uncomfortable. And sometimes you will definitely not like what's being questioned. You won't like the implications behind it. They could be whether that comes from the right, the left, or anywhere else outside of the kind of political spectrum. But that's fundamental to what a university must do and must protect. And that's why I think, in general, administrations of universities do the best when they offer a very wide latitude for speech. As I've said, it goes to the mission, not just to a sort of First Amendment principle.
Yeah, yeah. Ashika, I want to talk a little about the idea that these students are, quote unquote, breaking the rules, and that the demonstrations that they're engaging in are disruptive, which is the point of protest, of course, is to disrupt the sort of normalcy, to draw people's attention to the issue. Does that disruption, I guess, give license to the response from authorities, whether they be college presidents or the police, to disband those protests? I mean, this is something we've struggled with for a long time in this country. What is that limit where the disruption of a demonstration or a protest is the reason to act, to say, you know, you can't do this anymore? And at what point, I guess, does that reaction reach that level of authoritarianism that you spend a lot of time thinking and writing about?
It's a good question, Stephen. So just to back up a little bit, I think, first of all, to pick up on Professor Rosenfeld's point about polarization right now, I think we cannot underestimate that context and how it's playing out. And that plays out in the core mission of universities in many, many different ways. There is a tension in the mission of the universities as to whether they should be about inquiry or activism. Mm-hmm. Social justice activism occurs when the moral questions have been settled, that you know what the right answer is, you know what the right course is, there is a massive social injustice that's just intolerable, and all that's left is activism. Inquiry is different, right? Like, inquiry requires parsing different points of view in a somewhat dispassionate, if heated, kind of manner. This issue, the South Africa issue and discrimination, I think the moral questions were much easier to settle, mm-hmm. because nobody was in favor of apartheid. Nobody thought that the white regime in South Africa was a legitimate regime imposing legitimate policies. The Israel and Palestinian question is much different. And there are factions on campus that have very different views about what the moral issues involved are, and both sides have some claim. And that's sort of playing out on college campuses right now. So I think especially precisely because the moral claims are contested, mm-hmm. and in competition with each other, you do need to uphold the ethos of inquiry. When it comes to disruption, there is no protection for, strictly speaking, from a free speech perspective, there is no protection for disruption. I mean, civil disobedience has consequences, and mm-hmm. Martin Luther King urged us all, when you have moral clarity, you break the rules deliberately and you face the consequences. Mm-hmm. And so if the students, to some extent, are having to face the consequences, that is part of the the program of activism. That's part of their program of activism. But I think for college campuses, when they take action against disruptive activity, they really should ask, is this in the furtherance of the mission of inquiry and understanding, or are they simply trying to chill a particular viewpoint, in this case, a pro-Palestinian viewpoint, because that's what the protests are about.
Right.
And my fear is that the authoritarian comes in, and I think this is very clear in Colombia. It is not really about maintaining an environment that is conducive to dialogue. It is more that our congressional leaders have decided that they do not like the leftist position on Gaza. They have very cleverly weaponized the whole trope of anti-Semitism against it, and they are using it to thwart and crack down on a certain viewpoint.
Yeah, yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here. You can go to Twitter and hashtag created equal or at WDET. Let's start today with Roger in Ann Arbor. Roger, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Stephen. It's a pleasure. Mm-hmm. Let me just say, I'm a four-time degree earner from the University of Michigan, including the law school, and I've lived in Ann Arbor for many years. It's interesting, just as a contrast to the kind of way things are being handled in Texas and New York and elsewhere. I was on campus in the DIAG Friday, and virtually the entire DIAG is occupied by tents, and they have speakers. It's easy for students to get around still to their classes. The only evidence of a uniformed police officer I saw, and I was down there for quite a while, was a single police officer in a car that was well outside the eyesight of the DIAG.
Hmm.
So it's interesting that I think they've taken, you know, a different approach here, perhaps like what was described, I believe, by one of your guests at the University of Pennsylvania. And the other thing I want to say is I am shocked at what's going on in Colombia. And I have to say that it really reflects an overreaction of a weak, inexperienced leader.
Hmm.
And I also am concerned about the reported or at least speculated influence of donors on decision making.
Yeah. Yeah. Roger, I really appreciate your call and, of course, your dutiful reporting of what's happening in Ann Arbor and what's going on campus there. There is a protest that has been taking place there for several days, and you're right, there has not been the same kind of response that we've seen on other campuses. But your question, I think, about the influences here, the external influences on some campuses that seem to be leading presidents to make decisions is important. And Dr. Rosenfeld, I want to have you address what Congress seems to be, what role Congress seems to be playing or have played in some of these campus decisions, but also donors to the university. This is about money on some level. The protesters want divestment of these universities in assets that benefit Israel. No one has been able to, for me, really define what that would mean, but that's what they say. Money does drive a lot of decision making, though, and so does politics. How do we make sense of that, Dr. Rosenfeld?
It's a great question, and I appreciate it being asked, because the politics and the money, in a sense, go together. We saw in the first Trump era, let's call it that, a lot of attacks on the press, as particularly the institution that was leading ordinary Americans astray,
mm-hmm.
and fake news and all of that. And universities were not a big part of the story in the end of the last decade. That's shifted quite a bit in recent years. And I think we have to see the protests around Gaza as following on what became an increasing attack on schools as the mediating institution, less than the press now, that's sort of in between ordinary Americans and the state. And You could see Ron DeSantis's efforts, for instance, in Florida and the public education system. And then I think what happened is that a class of donors, generally right-leaning donors, saw an opening in the private universities as well to say, you know, you've gone too far. You've gone too far towards DEI. You've gone too far towards a kind of so-called woke agenda. Mm-hmm. And this became, this was a sense, an opportunity, almost a kind of Trojan horse situation in which claims of anti-Semitism, sometimes real. So I don't want to dismiss the fact that there's never anti-Semitism. There certainly is, and it needs to be eradicated wherever it is. But some kind, but anti-Semitism became a larger kind of trope, a way of arguing against a whole woke agenda. And it galvanized some donors. It galvanized some political figures. In my own university, University of Pennsylvania, the president was really driven out by a combination of big donors who had felt they should be able to steer the direction of the university, backed by some political voices, both in the Democratic and the Republican parties, that backed that line, that really boxed in the president on questions of both free speech and anti-Semitism. Hmm. I would even say they were kind of weaponized against her. And so I think we have to read the reaction to the protests, especially at Columbia, in response to donors, in response to political pressures, and in response to a larger kind of battle against universities as a whole that is not brand new, but coinciding with this repression of pro-Palestinian demonstrations. University presidents have every right to make sure that activities don't get violent, disruptive, to the extent that people can't attend classes or can't live in their dorms. I mean, there are limits for sure. But it does sound like what I'm hearing, the description of Michigan, sounds like, when possible, the right approach. Negotiate, hang back, mm-hmm. try to keep things calm, peaceful, undisruptive, and let students do what they do.
Yeah. Earlier this year, or I should say last year, we saw the Harvard president have to resign over political pressure for, you know, an answer she gave in a congressional hearing that many people thought was insufficient. There were several other presidents who appeared in front of that same panel in Washington. Do you think that sent a signal to presidents about the precariousness, I guess, of their tenures, that saying something in a congressional hearing could lead you to lose your job, which is not, I think, when you become a college president, what you're thinking about in terms of what your job even is?
Oh, yes. I'm sure that it's had a chilling effect everywhere. I mean, it sent a signal for sure that this is particularly the kind of third rail of academic life, that when you got into this space, speech, anti-Semitism, protest, there were very few good lines to take, and that you'd be attacked on all sides. It's easy to lose the support of donors and the external forces, but it's also easy to lose the support of students and faculty and internal voices. And I'm right now, for instance, the president of Columbia is finding herself being assailed for different reasons from both within and without. The only reason that the faculty senate decided not to come up with its harshest kind of judgment on her is that they felt they would be doing the work of the committee that had called her to testify in the first place. But they've, in a sense, converged around the idea that she's got it all wrong.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure anybody has quite the right formula, but I have seen some university presidents in the last week do a much better job of articulating how they were going to balance academic freedom on the one hand and the normal functioning of their universities on the other.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Dr. Sophia Rosenfeld of the University of Pennsylvania and Ashika Dalmia of The Unpopulist. We are going to hear more from you, our listeners, as well on the phones and on social. We've got a number of people queued up to join the conversation. If you'd like to join, 313-577-1019 is the number here. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag created equal or at WDET. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you're with us. We're talking about the protests, the pro-Palestinian protests on college campuses and the response on many of those campuses. College presidents, in some cases, calling in the police to disband these demonstrations, saying that they are too disruptive. We saw a particular instance of this last night in New York City at Columbia University. We are talking with Dr. Sophia Rosenfeld, who is chair of the Department of History at the University of Pennsylvania, where she teaches European and American intellectual and cultural history. Also with us is Shika Dalmia. She is the president of the Institute for the Study of Modern Authoritarianism, also runs a Substack called The Unpopulist, which is devoted to defending liberal democracies. We want to hear from you, the listeners, about what you make of all of this, the limits of free speech, and the response that you think presidents on these campuses have to indulge to be able to manage these things. 313-577-1019 is the number here. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag us or at WDET, and we can include you. Let's go next to Megan in Warren. Megan, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning.
Hey.
So I'm 100% in support of the protest and the Free Palestine movement. And we are coming up into an election year. And so many of us on the left are having this knee-jerk reaction about voting because it's become clear that no matter who's in power, we are losing our right to protest and our elected officials that we hired are not listening to our demands about this and many other things. And I know that objectively the right is worse. I want to hear from somebody that is smarter than me about what we are supposed to do here, because I'm just having this knee-jerk reaction and I know that I have to vote, but
So Megan, what you're saying is that you feel like the right is worse, but the alternatives on the left or in the Democratic Party aren't sufficiently better in your judgment. Is that fair?
And it's such a pervasive idea among people on the left that we can't vote for what is happening and continue supporting the left when they're just as bad on some issues.
Yeah. Megan, I really appreciate the call and that perspective. It's something I hear an awful lot from my friends on the political left. Shika Dalmia, you have been writing and thinking about the creep of authoritarian instinct and authoritarian policymaking. Help Megan out here. Is it just a fear that comes from the American right, or are we at a point where choices and decision makers on the left represent that same creep of authoritarian thought?
So first of all, let me say that I completely agree with the caller that the right, and as you know, Stephen, I come from the center right, is a much bigger threat to liberalism and liberal democracy and any cause of social justice that anybody may favor. So I don't think there is a comparison between the right and the left. If you notice, the worst violence on college campuses, regardless of what you think of the protests, hasn't come from the protesters. It has come from the authorities who are trying to quash them. And by and large, the authorities have been called in either by right-wing political leaders or at the behest of the right, especially in Congress. That said, how should we vote? I'm not here to give anybody advice on which candidate they should vote for, but here it would be my consideration. In a liberal democracy, we don't have a right to have our political preferences enacted right away. That is not liberalism. Liberalism is to have those ideas admitted in the public discourse and mm-hmm. thoroughly parsed out and debated. No party is going to completely escape conventional wisdom and the existing zeitgeist. And that is the case with Democrats and that is the case with Republicans. But I think you have no shot at having your concerns heard if you have, a Donald Trump reelected, whereas you can have a conversation, with the other side.
Yeah.
And so I think the thing to keep in mind is liberalism is a deliberative system. It is not a system that will deliver you your perfect outcome tomorrow, but it will allow your preferences to be debated, discussed, and advanced in an incremental, if slow, way. And so keep that in mind.
Yeah. On college campuses, Dr. Rosenfeld, this idea of authoritarianism, I know, is on a lot of students' minds. How do you help them make sense of that, and how they should resist it?
Well, I think it's important to say, first of all, that professors generally are not in the position of sort of sharing their own politics directly. I mean,
right.
We don't, the myth is some kind of indoctrination, but I think when I end a semester of teaching, students often have no idea exactly where I stand on a variety of issues, and I like it that way. Because what I'm trying to do is exactly as just was just suggested, teach the process of mulling over ideas, exploring them from multiple perspectives, deciding which ones stand as they get tested against each other. And that's a very different process than sort of telling them what to think. But I couldn't agree more that the virtue of a liberal democracy is exactly in that deliberative process. What we're really teaching students in the end is how to be thinkers who can be citizens more than a set of ideas. And I will say that I couldn't agree more that though it is unlikely that people on the sort of farther left than the center of the Democratic Party today are going to find themselves not in accord with everything that Biden administration is trying to do, they have a much better chance of being able to enact those kind of democratic principles by engaging within the left. And that is to say, they're just trying to move the needle. Mm-hmm. I don't think students really think, for instance, that tomorrow every major university is going to pull out of every company mm-hmm. that does business in Israel. Mm-hmm. It's an impossibility. That isn't even how investing works. Mm-hmm. But they are subtly moving the needle so that even the comments of Biden or Blinken or others sound a little different than they did a few months ago. The negotiating may go a little differently. Domestic politics are going to be at play here, too, in an election year. So I see students, if they really understand what they're doing, they're not offering absolute demands that need to be met any more than voters get to express exactly what they feel. They're just trying to push things a little bit in the direction that they long-term hope that they will go.
Yeah.
It isn't the most satisfying, maybe, process, but we don't vote to just express ourselves. We vote to try to push things a little bit more in the direction we prefer. And when we see the alternatives as particularly scary ones, it should be a particular kind of incentive to remake the Democrats in the way you'd like to see them exist.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think one more thing to keep in mind
for
your caller.
We've got about 30 seconds.
In which direction is the needle going to move if you get the authoritarian right in office? I think the directionality of it is also important, not just the pace at which you want change.
Right.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, Dr. Sophia Rosenfeld and Sheikh Adamia. It was great to have both of your voices as part of this conversation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
That's going to do it for us on Created Equal. Remember that you can listen to recent episodes of the show at WDET.org, and we would love if you would subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and by David Lines. Engineering is by Nate Bender. The audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music was created by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University. This is WDET-FM, Detroit Public Radio, your connection to news, music, and conversation.